Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Galaxy Geekdom podcast. I am one of your hosts, Crystal Williams. My pronouns are she, her. And wait a minute, I'm not alone today. I seem to have a guest.
No, you guest, don't. There's no one here.
Oh.
You're mistaken.
Okay. Oh, okay. Is it the demon in the corner?
Yeah, actually, yeah, this is a demon. Hi, my name is Pazuzu. I've come here to repossess a young girl. About 12 years old. I'm going to take her and we're going to make her eat some pea soup. We're going to give her some, you know, a bit of a chiropractic massage in the back of the neck. It's really going to turn your perspective around on that one. And then we're going to spit on some people. It's going to be great.
That's fun. I'm glad to have another demon around here. We usually just have the one demon who sits in the corner, but she doesn't like talk like you do. She kind of just like growls.
Well, you see, I don't like to tell people about this, but that particular demon, that's actually a raccoon. You may have an infestation in your house.
Oh. Okay. Do raccoons normally float in the air, though?
Well, some do. If they have some beans in the trash, what you're seeing is not actually floating. They are farting so intensely that they're levitating.
I see.
Yes, it's a common common mistake. Very common mistake.
Hey, should I check out this wound that I have from the scratch? It's kind of turning black.
Yeah, that might be gangrenous, I would say. The raccoon might have had rabies. You may want to get a vaccine for that or a shot.
That's okay. I'll just go take the chainsaw I have and cut off my arm.
Oh, that works too, actually.
Who's laughing now?
There we go. Exactly.
Now that we're done with our bit, do you want to introduce yourself to the people? I'm sure people who listen to the show already are familiar with your voice, but hopefully. It's good to reintroduce yourself. So welcome back to the show.
Hello, my name is Anthony Guglia. I am a writer of sorts. I have done many a thing. I actually finished writing a piece on The Exorcist, actually, given the opening number there. I've been doing a lot of things lately, and I'm here to chat with my very good friend Crystal about the one thing that's been on my mind for the last month. I'm here to only talk about Baldur's Gate 3 and nothing else.
Okay.
I'm just kidding, of course not, but you know how it is.
Well, we could definitely talk about that for sure. And there is something I found really funny that you brought up, The Exorcist. As a movie theater employee, mm-hmm. I've been keeping an eye on when release dates are happening, and I still find it really amazing and hilarious that as a Swiftie myself, that the existence of the Taylor Swift Eras Tour movie is one of the things that's currently going to be keeping movie theaters afloat. So we're in our strike for sure, in addition to the fact that it's so popular, it forced Blumhouse to change the date of The Exorcist from Friday the 13th back to the Friday the 7th, I think?
Or something 6th. Like that. They really took, I mean, honestly, it was perfect placement for a new Exorcist film. But, you know, Taylor Swift is, you know, listen, I wouldn't want to fight Taylor Swift in the box office.
No.
Especially with how many.
It's doing huge numbers.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't want to go up against that, especially if, you know, you're hoping to start a trilogy of horror films. And let's be quite fair, as someone who also is interested in movies as well as you are, horror has been one of the few successes this year in terms of reliable box office earners.
That is true.
Because horror is inexpensive to make in general. It's popular among a very devoted audience. That audience often does not overlap with other blockbuster audiences. You know, I mean, granted, horror fans are going to watch blockbusters too, but, you know, they turn out for horror films.
Oh, you're 100% right. Like I said, yeah. Working at movie theater, you see the crowd that comes for horror. It's a very distinct crowd.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We come out for that stuff.
They're very different from other genres of films, for sure.
And there's been some horror films that have come out that I haven't seen yet that I really want to. And I regret not going to the theaters to see it, but, you know, for one reason or another, couldn't make it.
Talk to Me.
Talk to Me was exactly what I was thinking of. That film looks incredible. I did not see it in theaters, unfortunately,
yeah, same.
But I want to. In fact, I just actually two nights ago, just finally saw Renfield. It was on Peacock.
Oh, so I watched it. Yeah.
What do you think of Renfield? I'm curious.
I saw it a few months ago and I thought it was fun.
Yeah, right.
Kind of forgettable, but it was fine. You know, like I enjoyed it for the about 90 minutes it was on. I liked the cast. I think they're all very charming.
It was weird though that they decided to make a mob movie and have Dracula with a cameo appearance though. That was kind of strange.
It definitely wasn't really like your typical horror scenario. It was like an action movie, really.
Yeah, it was interesting. I'm not sure.
It was fun.
I had fun with it, but I'm not sure. Like, the problem is, like, the parts I liked, I really liked, and everything else was kind of like, okay, this is fine. Let's get back Nicolas Cage.
I like Ben Schwartz in it, but
Ben Schwartz is funny in general. I like him in most things. It is funny, though, because my spouse was unaware that Ben Schwartz was also Sonic the Hedgehog.
I know.
So halfway through, I make a joke about, Sonic getting, something involving Sonic. And you know, it starts a conversation and it leads to, it's just weird, though, isn't it? Like, I don't know. I like Ben Schwartz in general. But, I feel like I could use more Nicolas Cage. Yeah, it could use more Nicolas Cage, I feel like.
Well, that's I mean, a lot of movies could use more Nicolas Cage.
Honestly, you can't tell me that Titanic would not be better if Nicolas Cage wasn't in the movie.
He should have been the boat.
He would have devoured the iceberg with how much scenery he chews in most movies he's in. I'm just saying right now. Although when they did kind of make Titanic with Nicolas Cage, the SS Indianapolis movie, surprisingly boring.
They didn't let him cage out.
They did not let him cage out. They tried making it a serious movie, and they forgot the most important thing, which is Nicolas Cage needs to be caged. You cannot cage Cage. He has to be unleashed.
I do think a movie recently where he was a little bit more, I mean, not as what you would expect. Did you see Pig?
Yes. That movie's incredible. But, like, I also think, like, I think Nicolas Cage brings the right energy to the right role if he's, like, passionate about it. Like, he knows when to tone it down. Pig's incredible. Adaptation's incredible. Leaving Las Vegas is incredible. And he's, like, amazing in those films. Like, he just brings that right energy. And in the first half of Mandy, he's actually really subdued, I thought.
That's so nice to see Mandy. That's on my
Mandy's
list.
Mandy's incredible. Mandy's incredible. Crystal, you got to freaking see Mandy. It's so freaking
I know. It's up my alley.
Yeah. You want to see Nicolas Cage in a tiger shirt with no pants on, chugging vodka while screaming?
Yeah.
Then Mandy has that. That happens with 3 minutes of Mandy. It's a 3-minute shot in Mandy. There's Nicolas Cage in his bathroom. Just chugging vodka, screaming, chugging more vodka, keeps screaming, and then he goes and kills a bunch of people. It's great. It's essential. How can you not love that? I'm just saying. How can you not love that?
That sounds amazing, especially since I've seen Willy's Wonderland, and some of the best scenes of the movie are... You saw it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Of course. Some of the best scenes in the movie are just him on his breaks, when he takes his breaks.
Just playing pinball.
Yeah, playing pinball. Chugging those energy drinks, the funniest parts of that whole movie. Like, yeah. I think that movie is not great, but I think that anything with Cage in it is like 10 out of 10.
I think it's interesting because, you know, they're releasing the Five Nights at Freddy's film this October. And
which I do want to see.
I am curious, mainly because of Matthew Lillard, I'll be honest with you. It's mainly because of him that I want to see it because he's just so entertaining. But I find it funny how, you know, you took how many years to capitalize on this franchise?
I'd say it started getting really popular in 2012 or 13.
right? Like a 10 years. So
yeah,
all these other guys beat them to the punch by a few years, not even like a month. It's not like they just wedged in there. There's been like a few years between the Banana Splits movie, Willy's Wonderland, and the Five Nights at Freddy's movie.
Yeah, and of course, don't go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, even got the Blood and Honey movie that came in like months after. Oh. Like, I just feel like they really did not act fast enough with Five Nights, personally.
I was following the production of the film, and I think one of the reasons why that is the case is because Scott Cawthorn kept turning down scripts.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, because there's so much plot in... Because the books that he approved are so well written. The books he signed off. Oh, I've had a couple of them. Out of curiosity, because I'm like, you know, you go to the bookstore, you're looking in the YA section to get the new Layboy Dugo novel. You're going to pass by the Five Nights at Freddy's shelf, and you're going to go, wow, these all look terrible. I got to know. It's like when you go to the section, you have the Disney books that are like the villain spinoff books, and you're like, these don't look good. I have to know what's inside these pages. And you read them and you go, well, that's kind of fanficky in a not great way, and I'm not really a big fan of these. But, you know, I don't regret looking at them. These were the opposite. I feel like my brain cells shriveled reading these books. I don't know. I don't know how anyone would – I mean, I guess the only reason they'd sign off on it is – I don't know. They felt so they felt like they only existed to fill in the gaps of lore so fans could theorize. And they didn't feel particularly compelling stories in and of themselves, if that makes sense.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. Like
I started reading the first book years ago, and I enjoyed it, but I never finished it.
You see, that's the problem right there. You know, like,
I'm also just not great with like reading, keeping up with novels. The only reason I've been able to be more on top of things is when I do audiobooks.
Hey, that's fair. Audiobooks are great. I'm listening to Pet Sematary right now, an audiobook for Halloween. It's fantastic. They got Dexter.
That's one of the few books I actually, like, a few years ago, I sat down and read the entire thing of that. And I'm glad because I never saw any of the – I wanted to read a King that I never saw any of the movie adaptations for. So oh, I didn't have any preconceived – no.
You never saw Pet Sematary?
No, I still haven't.
Oh, no. That's a good one. I mean, I like – let me be honest. The problem with Pet Sematary – and you've read the books. You know the basic plot. You know the plot of it, right?
Yeah, no, I know the story. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Cool. The problem with the Pet Sematary film, I feel – there's actually two problems, I think, with the original. The remake has more problems. But the original, the issue is they really compress it. And with a book like Pet Sematary, it's you can get the plot beats down, but like what makes that book so powerful are all the character moments and the humanizing elements and how...
Yeah, that book is very much about that, you know.
Yeah, so the film whittles it down to like an hour and a half. So it's just the plot beats. None of
honestly,
the
horror elements in the book are pretty far and few between. A lot of it's just like the characters ruminating about grief and death and loss and their own issues. You know,
it's a grim book. It's a very depressing
book. Yeah, it's a very depressing book. Yeah,
but the film is not as depressing. And I also don't think all the acting is all that great in the movie. I think the lead guy who they get to play the main guy in Pet Sematary, I just thought he was very bland. In both versions, I thought he was bland. But what's funny about the original is that all the side characters are so memorable and they're so well acted. And like the main character will like react to things and just have like a blank expression on his face. With the exception of when his spoiler for Pet Sematary, but when his son dies, that's the only time you see like genuine acting from the actor. Every other scene, he's just like has a look of bland disinterest in his eyes.
Yeah, that sequence is definitely one of the harder points to read in the book.
Oh, the book is heartbreaking.
Yeah, heartbreaking.
There's the fight in the funeral and during the wake. It's like it's awful. It's so depressing.
But it felt real, you know.
It feels genuine.
Yeah.
That being said, though, the best part about the film, there's two great parts. One is the what's his name? Herman Munster. He was in My Cousin Vinny. What's the actor's name?
Oh, I can't think of it. He's the one who plays the his neighbor.
Yep.
That's the character's name. I'm blanking. It's been a few years since I read it.
I'm listening to it right now. I'm going to cheat and double check this just because I feel like I'm not. Like, I'm literally reading. Oh, Judd. Judd.
Okay, yeah. Judd.
And the actor's name is Fred Gwynn. There we go. Fred Gwynn.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Great, great character actor. Fantastic.
Yeah, he was great in My Cousin Vinny. Yeah.
Oh, he's the best. And he has, like, he has all the mannerisms down. And the other great thing, which I think is great in the sense that it disturbed me, but I'm not sure, the way they do the sister, Zelda, in the original, in the Pet Sematary movie, the first one, is horrifying and genuinely disturbing. And, like, I found everything involving that character, like, traumatizing, when I saw it as a kid. The remake, not so much. I thought the remake really dropped the ball on every element of the film and story, but, you know, that's another story for another day. But yeah, no. So I've been babbling about Stephen King this whole time, and I will, mind you. I mean, it's almost Halloween. I'm down. Oh, it's almost Halloween. It's
about
2 months
from
Halloween.
So.
Yeah. I was reading a thing.
I read,
sorry, I cut you off.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I read a thing the other day with Stephen King was saying that his wife almost left him because he wouldn't stop playing Mamba Number 5 in the house. And I felt that just that rings true. That sounds about right.
That sounds like a horror writer to me.
Yeah, that's pretty terrifying, I'm not gonna lie. I'm playing Mamba Number 5 all day long.
I need to go back. I read at least 4 or 5 of the Dark Tower books.
Oh my god, yeah, Dark Tower is incredible. That whole series is just brilliant.
It's crazy. Also, King does have an issue of, like, writing black characters with a particular accent that's
little
bit uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, no. He has a bit of a problem there with black characters.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue with one of the main characters in that series. And then there's weird SA stuff in some of them. Like,
oh, tons.
Yeah, but it's also, like, surreal and at times absolutely disgusting in the depictions of gore. And, like,
yeah, 100%. A little
like,
bit.
There's a paragraph in the first book where I read, or like, this is pretty vomit inducing description of gore. Stomach turning description, you know?
Yeah, no. Some of the stuff that King writes is just so disgusting across the board with all of his works. Like, some of them get, like, really, really disgusting and grotesque and vile. And, yeah.
But it is horror, I suppose, so that's kind of the thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, if they weren't absolutely repulsive, I think Stephen King once said something to the effect that you should, like, try terrifying or creeping out your audience first. But if it comes down to it, a good gross-out scene is always just, you know, always gets the job done.
Like, that works.
I know it's not a movie, a book, but Stephen King's work on Creepshow with George Romero.
The
scene that I
love Creepshow.
Oh, it's fantastic.
I love
Creepshow.
I love Creepshow.
But the scene that always stands out to me is the cockroach scene at the end.
It's very, it's very gross.
Oh, it's foul. It's fantastic. I love it. But it's so repulsive and so disgusting. And the fact that he used real cockroaches just, like, gets me. You could say that gets under my skin. You could say that. but no.
My favorite story in that one is the crate. That's my favorite story.
That one's pretty good. I like that one.
I think I like it because it's a good monster story. You know, like.
Oh, yeah. I think for me, my favorite might be the one with Leslie Nielsen. Because it's so simple. Like, it's just one set piece. Essentially,
well,
in the fallout.
So vile character that Leslie Nielsen plays.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, we're so used to him from, like, Naked Gun and, like, the scary movies and all those.
Yeah.
So it's, like, it's funny seeing him play someone who's so vile and so, like, cruel and vindictive. But, like, what's funny is, yeah, the decades before Airplane, he was known as a dramatic actor.
Yeah. That was, like, 80... The Creepshow was, like, what, 82?
I think 80. I want to say 80.
Was it 80?
Okay. I'm going to cheat, as I always do in these discussions, and, like...
It's good to know the actual
facts,
though.
It is 82. It's 82.
Okay, so
yes, you're right.
I was right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you're correct.
So that would have been around the same time that Airplane released.
Yeah, roughly. Airplane was 80, so 2 years after.
Okay.
Actually, this
so
is the same year
still
Airplane
was...
2 came out. Airplane 2
okay,
was
80. Okay, so he was still in, like, his traumatic... He hadn't fully transitioned into comedic yet.
Yeah, he wasn't bringing the fart bag to interviews on Letterman at that time.
Right. So, okay, so that... It does make sense, but he's great in that little short, and he's also terrible, and the ending is so perfect.
Oh, yeah, it's so great. It's such, like, karmic.
A lot of those stories about karma. It's horrible people getting what they deserve in the end.
I love that. And I love that, like, Tales from the Crypt style karma that they always have in those stories. Like, Tales from the Crypt does it, too. Mm-hmm. Most of the, what was that company called?
EC
did it too, but, well, EC is the one I'm really thinking of, but there was another British studio that did the Tales from the Crypt movie from the 70s.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
They did a few other movies too, that I am now blanking out on, but they always had that, that style about them where they would have those, like, karmic twist endings, you know, that, like,
yeah,
really...
No, worked. I like it.
They also did, what was that one? I'm going to cheat again, because I don't see myself remembering anything properly. But there was, Amicus Productions. That's the name of the studio. And they did one... that I had seen years ago, Asylum. You ever see that one, Asylum?
I think I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
It's from 1972, and it's one of those, like, really strange movies. It's like another anthology film. They go to an asylum, and every patient has a story. And there's one where this, I want to say this woman... And this guy, they murder someone.
Mm-hmm.
And, no, I'm sorry. This guy murders his husband. That would be really progressive if they had a gay character in a British horror film from the 70s. No, this guy murders his wife. And, the limbs start moving. And the limbs start getting up. They're all wrapped up in bandages and they start moving around the house. And it's simple, but it's a great, like, little... It's very creepy and very effective because you just see, like, an arm crawling under the bed. You know, oh, the arm's right there. That means the torso's over here and the head's over there. It's simple, but it's really funny. And
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and it's all basic, simple stuff. It's quite clever. I like it a lot. There's a few of those that were really good. But anyway, I'm babbling too much. I can talk about old horror films all day, as you very well know.
This is the podcast to babble.
Oh, that's very true.
This is the existence of this podcast, to have tangents and to go off on long, random conversations that no one else would give a shit about, but we definitely do.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, that's actually one thing I didn't realize. So I was looking up Amicus Productions' body of work. One of their last things was an adaptation of the people that it was a sequel to – it is a prequel. So it's an adaptation of The People That Time Forgot. which is a follow-up to the movie The Land That Time Forgot. And they're both based on Edgar Rice Burroughs' novels.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of this.
And if you know about Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know basically what kind of story that they're going to tell. They're adventure stories, and this one involves going to, like, basically an isolated society in, I think, the Arctic, where they encounter, like, somehow dinosaurs and cavemen have been preserved for, like, unchanged for millions of years. And I want to say the original, it's British and German soldiers, I think, from World War One, just find this island and they have to survive together. But some cool stuff. I don't know. I think it's cool.
No, it is.
I think it's cool stuff.
I love that stuff.
I find it funny how they went off on these big sci-fi films when, like, before they mainly stuck to really. They also did the Doctor Who movies from the 60s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the ones where the title was literally Doctor Who with, like, a DR period as opposed to the whole word Doctor spelled out.
Wow.
That's interesting. Too. Oh, yeah, those were weird. That was, like, the early days of that was when Peter Cushing played the Doctor.
Wow.
Yeah, which no one ever talks about because it's, like, a weird side thing. But, yeah, Peter Cushing at one point did play the Doctor, but he was literally called Doctor Who in this movie. He wasn't called the Doctor. He was just called Doctor Who, which is really strange considering how insistent the show is that the Doctor is named the Doctor. I don't know. I think it's kind of funny. This is like pre-regeneration, too. This is before they ever introduced the idea of regeneration or Time Lords or anything like that into Doctor Who.
Interesting. God, that series is... We won't get into a full Doctor Who discussion because we'd be here hours, but...
Oh, God, yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating. I never knew Peter Cushing played him.
That's, yeah, it's really odd. It's an odd that chapter odd. In Doctor Who history.
That's... There should be a whole documentary series about if there isn't already.
Probably as many. I always find it interesting when you go to, like, the early years of what becomes a big franchise and you look at all the strange spin-off material. Oh, especially if it's, like, a decade-spanning franchise where, like, it's become codified what the tropes and the world and all that is. Like,
yeah.
I love doing it with Pokemon especially. Because early Pokemon's weird. You get stuff like the Electric Tales of Pikachu, where they thought, yeah, let's give Pokemon to a hentai artist. I'm sure that would go wonderfully.
Oh.
Oh, you never heard of that? The Electric Tales of Pikachu?
I think I've heard of that, yeah.
They were already doing Pokemon Adventure, which is like the main manga. When you talk about Pokemon manga, that's the main one. There was a gag manga before that, though, with with Red and a foul-mouthed Clefairy. And those were, like, the two big manga for a while. This was, like, the third manga. This was, like, the next, like, a short-lived side thing that was more an amalgamation between the anime and the video games. So they do these really odd things where they play around with the world and the rules and all that. And it ends with Jesse and James. Jesse's pregnant with James's baby, and it ends with Ash marrying Misty. It also ends with a lot. It also has a lot of, shall we say, interestingly illustrated character designs. And I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
To the point where even, like, the Pokemon Company, well, what would become the Pokemon Company, reviewed the pages and they were like, let's revise this, actually. We have to publish this because that's all we have and we have a deadline. But for the trade volume, let's revise these slightly.
I do love that, like, companies like Nintendo and Disney, who are so, like, you know, like, protective of their family friendly-ish brand. How they have sections dedicated to, like, collecting and or, like, trying to cover up anything pornographic related to their material.
Oh, yeah. But that, like, makes it...
I still think it's hilarious that Nintendo owns the Super Hornio Brothers.
Oh, my God, yes. I love that. It's so ridiculous. But it, like, and it's
do you think there's like an archive of that? Like they have like a whole bunch of tapes in like some room?
Oh yeah, no, there's gotta be a tape. There's gotta be a vault under Shigeru Miyamoto's like house where you'll see him like with like the eye camera that goes in. he goes in, he gets like the retina scan, walks in, and like he takes like the super 8 like canister and just starts playing on a projector, and he just like nods to himself, going, "Yes, yes, this is." That's basically what it's.
I kind of want to break it and steal it for everyone.
Oh God, yeah, be like, we'll go. It's like
release the Horneo cut.
God, I wish. But I find it funny, technically, because of the guidelines that the Pokemon Company has with fan art, they technically own all Pokemon hentai that has ever been made.
That's so, amazing.
Like, all of Fur Affinity that has, like, their Pokemon and hentai, the Pokemon Company technically owns it based on the licensing agreements that they've written and can use it to promote their games. Without paying any of the fan artists as a result. It's really messed up, and I think that's morally reprehensible. But the implications of that if they ever want to, they can use hentai to market a Pokemon game. Something about that is very funny in a very sick kind of way.
It's really a giant coffee table book.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They could if they wanted to. But in their attempt to control everything, they now inadvertently just own all the hentai. Which is, I think, a beautiful... I think a terrible thing. What are we talking about? It's horrible.
But it's funny.
It's horrible that they're, like, exploiting fan artists for, like that. That's the awful part. The fact that the hentai exists is not awful. I want to make that clear. It's purely that they're exploiting artists. But, like... I don't know. I think it's very funny, personally, in a way.
I think it's both.
It's sad. It's sad. It's upsetting, and it's funny. You have to laugh, though, to get through the awfulness of it, though.
That is true. Yeah. You have to laugh through the pain.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
But, sorry?
Oh, there was just... Oh. speaking of artists and respecting artists, we are still in the middle of a writers and actors strike. And do feel like the internet doesn't know how to address having conversations about said material coming out during this time.
Yeah, you know? they still don't. And in fairness, it's not entirely their fault. Because like, what is the line between discussing media and promoting it?
You know, well, we're discussing it, and we don't get paid.
No, I would like to be paid.
So, for us...
Apparently, some critics on Rotten Tomatoes got paid to review, like, I don't know, a weird Shakespeare film no one saw. I would like that money, personally. I would love it if someone would just throw a few bucks my way whenever I happen to write positive material on the internet, but... I don't know.
So what I gathered, we're normal people like us, which we're considered normal, or at least me. I'm not paid for any of this. I'm not paid for the podcast. So we aren't breaking any SAG requests by not engaging with the material that's being released, right? Like, we are totally in compliance with everything, as far as I know. But I think the line is drawn when it's people who are generally paid to promote the material anyway. So like YouTubers, TikTokers, and media influencers who are given said products to review and promote. So that's kind of the line, I believe, where we are. But since we are not offered anything, we're not offered shit. We're totally cool to like keep talking and discussing these things. And there is no general like strike on the material that's being released. Per se, it's more about going against there's no boycott for everything.
Yeah,
right?
there's no call for boycott. No.
Yeah, so that, but I do think some people online tend to take that concept that anyone talking about it is inherently crossing some sort of picket line. I think that's an unhealthy way of viewing.
Yeah, especially because, like, the reality is that art exists, and art, I mean, I've avoided mentioning stuff on TikTok because, you know, I don't want to talk about new media in a way that's like promoting it. But I do want to offer my opinion. That's the thing also. Opinion is very important, and reviews are not, review writing is technically not crossing the picket line anyway, you know? Like, you, right. if you want to make a review, you gotta make a review. I would say everything stinks is what I'm gonna say. Just to be the negative voice in the room for the fun of it.
You'd be like, was it Jay Sherman?
Oh, something like that, yeah.
From The Critic, remember?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. I was watching...
It stinks.
I was watching clips from The Critic the other day where they have all the Orson Welles gags.
So that show is really funny. I'm still sad that it didn't last longer because it was really good.
Yeah, but a show like that could never have. It was never going to get a big audience like The Simpsons or King of the Hill.
No, I mean, like, when your lead characters, when your lead character is like a movie critic that's kind of making fun of Siskel and Ebert, even though Siskel and Ebert were in the show.
Which is great. Also,
it is hard to like draw that same sort of crowd. But it is a shame that that show kind of got like a footnote when quality wise it was pretty good, you know. Like
one gag,
obviously.
I'm sorry, I got cut you off there. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. What were you saying?
I was say one gag that I thought was really funny from The Critic was the when they did the Hunchback of Notre Dame musical in The Critic.
Oh yeah.
And then they just did that, and then Disney just made that. Essentially, not the same songs, obviously, because that's deliberately as dumb as possible. They're making fun of like how Les Mis got like a musical back in the 80s that was very popular, and then Disney just decided,
Simpsons did the Planet of the Apes musical, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But like, particularly like a tragic, like French, disturbing novel becomes like a popular blockbuster musical experience, and it's just like. It becomes really funny because you go, okay, who thought this was a good idea for a musical? Like, who thought, we're going to make a musical about, with Hunchback and the film specifically, we're going to make a musical about, we're going to make a Disney film, in fact, about a priest who, like, lusts over a racial minority and, like, wants to sexually assault her, enslaves an abused, tragically disabled man to get his way with things, and we're going to discuss, you know, themes of bigotry and themes of sexual assault and the predatory nature of the church and authority figures, and we're going to do all that, and we're going to make this into a Disney film or a stage musical. And it's like, who thought that was like, I don't know. I love Hunchback of Notre Dame, the book, the adaptations. I just think it's odd whenever anyone puts it to music.
I think sometimes musicals can work, but I feel so many adaptations are so weird. Like, Broadway's recent turn of making popular movies into musicals is turning some really weird and frankly kind of like really bland results, you
Crystal,
know?
Did you see Diana the musical?
No, I did not.
Diana the musical. Yeah, let's make a musical about the last days of Princess Diana. And let's make it, like, funny and goofy and silly. Let's make a silly movie about – a silly musical about someone who actually died.
Oh. Okay.
Within the lifetimes of almost our entire audience.
Oh, man.
It's just, and the people who are too young to know who Princess Diana was won't care. So it's like, who are you trying to appeal to? The people who've never heard of Princess Diana, or the people who did, who are going to be offended by this? Like, I don't know.
It's like a worse version of that fake musical from the show Smash. Do you ever watch that show?
Smash. I don't know if I have.
It was a drama musical-ish show about the entire process of bringing a musical to stage, including the writers, the songwriters and the actors, and like their intertwined drama and stuff between a bunch of characters. And they were producing a musical based on the life of Marilyn Monroe.
Cause that topic has never led to any controversial films at all or stories.
It's true. The show wasn't bad, and some of the musical numbers were pretty good, but I do find it weird that, like, the Diana one is worse than the idea that was created for a fictional television show.
Oh, yeah, it's designed to be terrible?
It's not designed to be terrible, actually, but it's just designed to be the show. It's designed to be the framing for what the rest of the show is. Like, do you get what I mean? Like,
I get what you mean. I'm not gonna lie. The visual I had in my head, and this might be wildly inaccurate, I was thinking of, what was that movie with, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ben Stiller, where they're doing a recreation of Jesus Christ Superstar. And Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, who's like this child star who, like, is obsessed with, like, his 15 seconds of fame, decides to play the parts of both Jesus and Judas at the very end, at the very last second.
I've not seen that movie.
You ever see this one? Oh, it's one of those, like, gross out comedies from the 2000s. Huh. It's famous too. I want to say there's something about Mary, but I want to.
I have seen There's Something About Mary.
Yeah, I'm going to double check that. I think it's Along Came Polly. I'm sorry. No, Along Came Polly. I'm sorry. Oh. I get those mixed up sometimes. Yeah, Along Came Polly. Mm-hmm. It's not good, but, like, I mean, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman. So, like,
okay, I remember this movie existing. I just don't remember that I saw it.
Always fun. Always fun. I always get to know that stuff.
Okay, so that's what that's about. Huh.
Well, I mean, that's like a subplot.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, so I said that's like a subplot.
Okay.
You know, it all works out. It's all good, honestly. It's all pretty funny stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's something about, Mary. Wow. I'm very articulate.
No, I was looking up the cast of Smash because I'm trying to remember who was in it. Catherine McPhee was in it. Deborah Messing and Leslie Odom Jr. Huh.
Yeah, there's a lot of those character actors in it.
Yeah, a lot of musical actors.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Character. Well, Deborah Messing played one of the writers, so she never, like, performed, you know. But mm-hmm. then they had some of the singers, like Catherine McPhee. Angelica Houston was in it.
Wait, she's in that?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was called Smash. It lasted maybe, like, 2 or 3 years.
I need to watch this show.
It's actually not bad. Really, it's not bad. If you want a fun ABC, or no, NBC. It was an NBC drama show with, like, musical numbers and, like, drama about, you know, relationships and working dynamics behind the scenes of a Broadway production. You know, it's kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It was an interesting show that lasted a bit. I'm sorry I get on that tangent. I was just thinking about the Diana musical.
Look, I went on an Amicus Productions tangent. I think it's okay for anyone else to talk to.
Yeah. And I'm sorry, but I don't understand why there's a Back to the Future musical. Like, I do and I don't.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up first, because I was afraid to say anything about that.
No, because I watched, like, a performance they had on, like, one of the morning shows or whatever, and the song was just bad. Like,
do they at least have, like, the Power of Love as, like?
Apparently, it does have all the songs from the movie as different musical numbers in addition to original songs.
Okay, because I'm gonna say, like, if you do a Back to the Future musical and you don't include either the Power of Love or that, like, scene where he's, like, rocking out on the guitar, like, what's even?
I will say the effects stuff that I've seen for the show looks pretty cool. They have the DeLorean that goes out. That's a physical vehicle. They've got, like, a clock tower. Apparently, the production values look good. It's just the actual musical itself. It seems like a very bad idea. Like, yeah. I feel like it's one of those movies that I feel like they keep trying to adapt these comedies into musicals, but then they stretch out the jokes that are really funny in like one or two lines into mm-hmm. full songs, and then it loses all of its charm.
Yeah.
I felt about the Christmas Story musical.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
really bad. And then I also felt the same about the... I know people tend to like this one, but I think the Disney adaptation of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the opening number being a song about fish, ruins the original joke.
Yeah, especially because that book is so blunt and to the point and like perfectly paced. And I was actually thinking of the few times it worked. Actually, I would say the Legally Blonde musical isn't so bad.
I heard that's not so bad. I heard the Mean Girls one's okay. I heard Beetlejuice one is actually fun.
Beetlejuice works, but then again, Beetlejuice is so unhinged by nature. Like, I feel like that can work quite well.
I also think they found a good lead who is charming and entertaining enough to play Beetlejuice that I think that works. It's kind of like the genie role in Aladdin.
Yeah,
I feel like those are very similar because both those versions are wink at the audience, breaking the fourth wall, zany sort of characters. And I think it may work because of that, you know?
Mm.
I think the Aladdin musical is quite good. The stage production of that.
Oh, yeah, no, 100%. I think most
of these musicals... I saw it, actually. It was cool.
Oh, you did? No, yeah. I've not seen it, but I've seen enough of it to know, get a gist for what it's like.
Yeah, when I was in New York in 2015, I think, it was on Broadway. So that I wanted to see at least one show, you know. I'm from LA. We only have like one or two like playhouses here. I mean, we have a few, but it's not like the same as New York. So it's like I wanted to be sure that I saw one while I was there, and so we chose Aladdin, and it was good.
No, you chose a good musical to choose, apparently.
A good safe one. You know what I mean? Like one that you know you have a good time going to, you know.
Yeah, no, it's funny because you're gonna make fun of me for this. I live right outside of New York City, as I have said multiple times. And I do not go to musicals nearly as much as you'd think I would, given the fact that I'm right by Hollywood. Like,
It's expensive, though.
Oh, it's very expensive. And I take the train into the city. I don't drive because I don't trust other drivers not to, like, destroy my car.
Never want to drive in New York City. No.
Oh, no. It's ridiculous. You're gonna get like someone. If you don't get someone like denting your car when you find a place to park, you're gonna get someone who like, hey, you got to pay for parking. That's more expensive than a train ticket. I'd rather walk around the city than be in a car. It's faster if you walk.
I walked and I took cabs when I was there.
That cabs are good. I like cabs. The subway's not bad if you know how to. If you know how to get around there, once you know how to use the subway, it's a game changer. I was visiting a buddy of mine in the city recently, and she lives there, so she knows where everything is, she knows where the good places to get food are, and she ended up getting us. She brought me to this one place that sells waffles that are, shall we say, shaped in a particular fashion.
Oh, the fun shapes.
Got you. Oh, the best shapes. And so, you know, you go to a waffle and they ask you, what type do you want? You ask, you know, do you want to have, shall we say, lip-shaped hot dogs? Or would you prefer a hot dog-shaped, sorry, not hot dogs, waffle. A hot dog-shaped waffle or a lip-shaped waffle? You got to go with the hot dog. Because there's nothing better than putting a big dick in your mouth. I mean, a hot dog in your mouth, as you do. Especially if it's covered in chocolate syrup and or melted caramel.
I need to find this place.
It is a great place. I I can show you it later if you really want to know.
Just send it to me.
100%. I will.
Next time I'm out there. Well, one. Next time I'm out your way. We gotta meet. Let me know. Number one,
Crystal. If you're in the Sedine time, let me know. I will take a train over there. Not a problem at all. It's so easy for you to get to the city. So long as it's not like a dying relative, I'll be there.
So that's number one, and then number two is when I go back. I'm going to there.
Yeah. I have to ask with my friend. Hopefully it's still open. I feel like a place like that is just too amazing not to keep open forever.
It should be open forever and never stop being open.
No. Never should close. I will say this, though. So I did mention at the top of this episode, I'm going to talk about Baldur's Gate, and I will. And I'm going to deviate the entire discussion to become about Baldur's Gate. Before I do that, Crystal, I have to ask you a question. It's very urgent. Did you know that video games have pronouns?
Well, damn it. Why can't they just keep their politics out of everything? I'm trying to enjoy my space game, and you're trying to fucking pronouns.
I know, it's ridiculous. And can you believe this, too? They have verbs in there, too.
Ah, fuck.
I just find it so funny. And I was saying before the episode started that something about this whole controversy bothers me. So Baldur's Gate 3 is, for one, a better game than Starfield. I think Starfield is kind of whatever. But Baldur's Gate 3 has been fantastic. And it's so versatile and so much to it. In terms of RPGs, you know, big, expansive world, what have you. But the thing is, Baldur's Gate 3 has a drag queen who runs a circus. And I.
So it's not only the game where you can fuck a bear.
Yeah, you can fuck a bear and a vampire at the same time. That's also something that can happen. Wow. And you can initiate tentacles. So I guess that balances it out with certain crowds. But there's a drag queen. I'm not sure if this character is literally a drag queen, but they're very much seem inspired by the drag queen aesthetic. They're in charge of a circus. They have a lot of mannerisms that are similar to RuPaul. So I have even though they look slightly resemble Divine in certain scenes. So I feel like if it's not literally a drag queen, I feel like they had drag queens in mind with this particular character. I haven't heard a single conservative mention this character at all. Possibly because it's late in the game and you'd have to actually play the game to find this character. That's one factor. That couldn't possibly be it, because I'm sure everyone who's complaining about Starfield has absolutely played Starfield for sure. And aren't just, you know, complaining about what's in the loading screen for some reason. Or the character creation scene for some reason. But I just find it interesting because when there's so little to talk about with Starfield, I feel like, in certain ways. Like, I mean, I think the game's expansive, there's a lot to it, but like, they're so desperate to grasp at straws that's what they're grasping at. Whereas with Baldur's Gate, there's so much going on in those games, I don't even think they know where to start. But I haven't seen anyone complain about Baldur's Gate having all bisexual characters. Like, every character is pan or bi, however you want to define it.
That's kind of amazing. By the way.
Oh, yeah. By the way.
The character you're talking about, I decided to do some Google, is a drag queen.
She goes by
Vinegar Strokes.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean.
Oh, the actor.
The actor. Yeah.
That explains everything. Okay, because I knew that voice was like, that sounds so familiar. Da, da. I was thinking, okay, that makes more sense. Okay, I get it now.
I was curious because I'm like, is it a drag queen? So, yes, a drag performer does play this character, Vinegar Strokes, who was on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Okay. There we go. There we go. That's why.
So now you know.
There you go.
I just did a Google search because I was really curious.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. This also, Baldur's Gate 3. By the way, is fantastic, and I love it. And I can see myself replaying this game multiple times, because there's just that much versatility with how you want to play the game. I do want to play a bard in my upcoming. I'm playing a warlock, a tiefling warlock, right now. Which, I mean, I know, a bisexual person playing a tiefling warlock. It's so different. I'm so special, guys. But I do want to play a bard at some point. I think it's interesting, like the different ways of different types of character dynamics. Might try doing. I also try doing some of the mods too. I don't know. There's a lot of the game that's so interesting and so developed. And I feel like the big takeaway is that gamers have been accepting subpar games for so long, you know? They accept games that do the bare minimum, or they want certain things like better graphics, when what you need is nuance and good character writing and just these expansive chances to role-play someone in a role-play game, as opposed to just going to point A, doing mission, doing side quest, and being kind of strung along on all these fetch quests. It doesn't feel like there's any meaning to it, like in those games. When I say those games, I really mean Bethesda. I really just mean Bethesda has been giving people the same experience for the last two decades and doesn't seem interested in innovating at all beyond this time doing Skyrim in space with less to do. In all these areas. Bethesda annoys me a lot as a company because it's just like they string you along for like a decade per game and they say, oh, this game's going to have 5,000 planets to explore. Meanwhile, they're all basically interchangeable. They're just like closed little sandboxes you can go into with a few different mountains and hills and there's nothing really. There's no chance of that, like, random discovery you get when you're playing Skyrim where you're like, oh, I'm going to walk in this one direction. I'm going to find this house, and there's going to be this weird skeleton, and there's going to be some, implication that there's a story here. And you can either read into that or you can ignore it entirely, and it's valid both ways. In, like, Starfield, it just feels like you can go off in any direction, and there's just nothing. It's just a lot of space to wander, and there's nothing really there for you. And I know that's an oversimplification, but it bugs me when games, they're so expensive to make, programmers are forced to do crunch time for all this stuff, and the direction of it is just more for the sake of more, but there's nothing really there that makes you feel like you're in a world that means something. I don't know. It just bugs me.
Yeah, I mean, I've had trouble getting into, like, larger RPGs kind of like that, like Bethesda's stuff. Like, I've tried to get into Fallout 4, and I didn't make it very far. And I think it mainly has to do with the fact that, like, my free time is so limited that when I get a game that's, like, massive, it's a little overwhelming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a little too much. So I tend to gravitate toward, like, linear narrative focused story based games. It's kind of why I'm really into like Naughty Dog's games or experiences. You know what I mean? Like they feel, mm-hmm. they feel like manageable, you know? I guess that's
no, yeah, there's more to it's less, but there's more, if that makes sense. Like there's less stuff, but the stuff there is means more.
It's because it's like highly polished, you know, exactly. And like that's why I'm a, like an Uncharted and Last of Us fan, because every inch of those games is kind of like polished to a degree where it's like you're interacting in a really good movie or television series, you know, and with something like Fallout or those type of games or Skyrim, I've always just had trouble like connecting as much, mainly because they're just, like I said, it's a little overwhelming. It's like there's 50 different quests you can do right now. Some of them will mean something, some of them won't.
And the other thing is like,
I was just saying varying qualities of like actual polish to these quests, mm-hmm. either. You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah. And the other thing also is, you know, with an Naughty Dog game, when you finish something, it feels like the world has changed. With Baldur's Gate, when you finish a quest, there are consequences that affect the playthrough.
Okay.
With Skyrim, you could walk up to, like, a Jarl, murder him, and no one, and like, aside from, like, the immediate fallout, the game doesn't really change. You just assassinated a leader of a city. And then if you pay the fine or whatever, you can come back later and, like, you're welcomed in with open arms. Everyone's fine. They treat you like you're it's like nothing, no tangible impact on the fabric of the world has happened because you just committed a attack someone like that, you know? It just feels like the world doesn't adjust or develop. It's very strange. And I'm not particularly a fan of that that particular component of those games. I don't know.
Everyone has their own, like, preferences to how you kind of want to interact with, like, an interactive medium. You know what I mean? Like,
100%.
I always find it weird, like, when people, like, complain about games being quote-unquote walking simulators or when they complain about games being too close to films. I always find that such a lame, like, complaint because it feels like they're intentionally trying to stifle certain creators from using that interactive medium in ways that works best for them. You
100%,
know?
100% agree with that. Yeah.
I don't know. You're boring to me if, like, you're complaining about the existence of Naughty Dog games feeling more like movies. Like, okay, what if I wanted to feel like a movie?
There are some games, though, that when they're walking simulators and they feel like walking simulators, but there's still something to the game. Like, I think Death Stranding is a good example of that, where the game is very bland if you look at it purely from a gameplay perspective. But there's more to it than that. You know, there's more going on. But the gameplay itself, it's like you're trying to get from point A to point B, avoiding obstacles, but you're just walking for the most part. But because of the world building and all those components, it keeps you invested. It keeps you going in an experience. There was one game
that
came out years ago. It was like an indie game where the whole game is you're an old man in a cemetery, and you take a seat at a booth, you get up, and you walk away, and that's the game. That's the whole experience.
Okay.
But, like, it's meant to kind of show – and it's like one of those, like, very small indie games. It's a 10-minute game. It doesn't take long. But
I like Gone Home. I remember that. I like that one.
Yeah. There's a few other good indie games like that. They're just very short and concise packages of an experience, and then that's it, and then it ends. I prefer that vastly over, you know, massively large games that there's just nothing really to it. And
that because there's thought put into every moment of that small experience.
Exactly. 100%. And the other thing also is that's important to keep in mind as well. I'm also fine with RPGs just railroading you in a single story, as long as it's a good story. Final Fantasy, I think, is a good example of this, where you don't get much in the way of opportunity with the classic RPGs to, like, change the plot at all. But the plot's so good that you're okay with that.
Sometimes you have to have very stable plots, you know, for it to be, like, a good experience. Like, some it's weird to, like, expect game developers to have stories that are always going to be interactive, you know, because like, it's like if you're reading a book and then you're mad you can't, like, not every book is a choose your own adventure story.
Exactly. 100%.
Yeah, you have to follow the so gaming is like any other art form. It's a medium where artists can reflect their internal story, the storytelling, the emotions of whatever they're feeling. Very much in line with, like, that. But I feel like gamers have come to expect them to not think critically in that artistic mindset. Like, that's why I still think so many gamers, especially the gaming community, is horrible at interpreting art. They really are really artistically illiterate in a lot of ways.
I would say they are, like all things, there's subsets, right? There's subgroups within
I'm not saying this is like all, yeah, but
Yeah, I would say that there are certain gamers who are, like, really in love with the way a world's developed, and they love the just being immersed in an experience. But then there are others who don't want to really be immersed. They want their experience to be – they want what they want and only what they want. And if it deviates from that a little bit, they blame the developer. Like, it's their fault that they didn't make a game perfectly curated to their interests. And they make it everyone else's business as a result. They make it everyone else's problem that they didn't get the exact thing they wanted. And I find that very immature because – you know, games are an art form, essentially. They are meant to immerse you in the creation of someone else. They're meant to put you in this landscape that's unlike your own. And we've come, I think, there's a period in time during the late 2000s. It was a high point in games in many ways. A lot of really good games coming out one after the other. But there were a lot of really generic, samey games, too, like all the COD clones and how every FPS game had to be desaturated and had to be like this certain set of gameplay mechanics. And it became very restrictive. It became very like a chokehold on what you could do. And a lot of clever FPS games that preceded COD, like for example, System Shock, I'd count as one of them. Halo, Half-Life. Fear was another one I think was really interesting. I'm talking about Call of Duty Modern Warfare, not COD as a general franchise. That was going on for years before that.
The Modern Warfare craze, because that was kind of like the start of that style of,
And I think Modern Warfare is a good, the original Modern Warfare is a good game. I'll say it right now. I think it's a really good game. I think the scene with the atomic bomb in COD is unmatched horror and peak what FPS games could have been in that era. They just chose not to do that is the problem.
Yeah, so I think a lot of studios also developed games in a way that they were
they were chasing the trends.
Meant to be like following said trends, products with not much unique qualities or thought, or games that are literally just like multiplayer experiences that don't expect you to like, it's just hard to like, they are artistic, but at the same time, they're not like curated experiences in that way. They're developed through multiplayer experiences among other people. And there are ways for these studios to kind of oftentimes make quick money.
Well, that's why Overwatch lost me. You know, like Overwatch started as a really interesting creative game. You have all these interesting characters who are all different from each other. They all are distinct. There's this world that's teased in the beginning of it, and you get the sense, okay, these characters are really interesting. I want to see where these stories go. And you're like, okay, it's a multiplayer experience. Okay, that's fine, but we're getting the story, though, eventually, right? Yeah, it's coming, don't worry. And you get strung along for a year, you get, like, breadcrumbs, and they just choose not to expand the narrative, and you just got strung along for so long. And if you really look at what you got out of Overwatch in those first few years, there wasn't a lot there. And this is not even getting into loot crates and all that gambling stuff. Like, I'm just talking like just straight up, what is the narrative of this game? Like, most of the content was all prequel stuff before the game officially started. It's all background details, but we only got it in like very slow trickles. I don't know. If I'm making any point, and I'm not sure I am, it's that I wish they Overwatch was better in terms of plot, and they were less, you know, pay to win nonsense.
Yourself. Definitely not helping the gaming industry with that. And I think a lot of that mindset that these games were. Not to say that multiplayer experiences are bad, but I do think the existence of multiplayer experiences like that can inherently cause certain subsets of the gaming fandom to kind of not view the gaming as a potential for telling great stories or for being an artistic medium that explores deeper themes. Do you know what I mean?
Agreed. It's multiplayer should expand the experience. It shouldn't limit it, I think.
I agree with that. And with that being said, you recommend Baldur's Gate over Starfield.
I also recommend Karlach as the best romance option in Baldur's Gate 3. There is no discussion for this. Astarion is just David Bowie, which is a good thing in some senses, but like Karlach is the whole package. Like, come on. That's, I think it's ridiculous how you could say anything but Karlach, honestly.
Ooh, I don't trust I hope the replies to this are filled with people angry that you said that. I would love
Karlach is top tier. Astarion, he's all right. It's okay. Not Karlach, though. And Shadowheart is, I think, second, I think, under. And then, of course, is that one drow who I actually, when I first played it, I just destroyed her in 5 seconds. I just killed her. I didn't even bother talking to her. I just attacked her and asked questions. Because I went in, like, to the place where you meet this one. I can't explain this unless you've played Baldur's Gate, but there's a section where you have an option to recruit one of the villains to your side if you make a certain set of choices. I just killed her without even asking her who she was. I've been told that's a bad thing to do, but I did that, so I did.
You did it.
And that's what I do. Yeah, that's how it went.
Well, I'm going to have to at least look into Baldur's Gate to see if it piques my interest at all.
I will send you
a lot
of
games coming out this year. Okay, cool. I'll have to. There's a lot of games I'm still behind on this year, and I'm really excited about Mortal Kombat. But
oh yeah, same.
Did you see before we got to wrap this up? But before we go, did you see the latest actress who's in the game now?
Aside from Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, aside from Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Oh, I don't actually know. Who?
Megan Fox.
Really?
Yes.
Megan Fox.
Yes.
Oh, I am curious.
She's playing a vampire type character.
Oh.
Vampire Natara.
Natara? Oh, and from Deadly Alliance? That's interesting. That's an unexpected character. That's surprising. That's really interesting. Oh, I am curious now. I really want to see this work out.
It's her voice and face.
So basically what you're saying is she's basically doing Jennifer's body in Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
There we go. Perfect. Love it. Fantabulous. I had no idea. That's so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, right?
I love it.
So that is my number one anticipated game this year. I love the Mortal Kombat series. That is a multiplayer game where I feel like they artistically are as genuine as I can be, at least in terms of telling pretty good stories in each game. So.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, no, I love Mortal Kombat. That was the first game I ever played, actually, the second Mortal Kombat.
Oh, wonderful.
Oh, yes.
I'm glad it's still here being awesome.
Oh, yeah, same. It's just so brutal and fantabulous. I love it.
And with that being said, I think it's time we wrap up the show. Do you want to plug where people can find you?
Yes, absolutely. You can find me on Twitter and the TikTok as my name, AGRAMUGLIA, on both of those sites. You can find me I have things published on sites such as Dread Central, The Anime Herald, Anime Feminist. I've had bylines on Polygon, CBR, other websites as well that are just not coming to mind quickly enough. But I'm also on Blue Sky now, so when Twitter, and I'm always going to call it Twitter, inevitably collapses into the sea, there is Blue Sky. So I'm there too, when the same name is on Twitter.
Beautiful. And in addition to that, my name is Crystal Williams, obviously. You can follow me at Crystal W. Rocks on Twitter, but I'm also on Blue Sky, and a couple other platforms as well. In addition to, you can read my Medium articles under Crystal Williams. I also, on the Twitter account, I have a link to my link tree, which will link you to all the places you can find me. So with that being said, thank you everyone for listening to another episode of the Gals of Geekdom podcast. Thank you for being back on with us, Anthony.
Oh, anytime you ask me to join you, I will show up. Don't ask me.
You are an official, unofficial member of our podcast family. So you definitely are welcome to come back as many times as you enjoy.
Oh my goodness. I will ask you, come the Halloween season. I will harass you about that for real.
We will do Halloween episodes together.
Oh, fantastic. I love it. Yeah. I love it.
And with that being said, thank you everyone for listening. We love you, and we'll see you on the next episode.
All right.
Bye.